we try to get bans on things like private ownership of wild animals because it is so dangerous, because there's the zoonotic disease transfer risk, because it's not good, it's cruel to the animals, and it damages their welfare.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Orad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Devon Shoey. Devon works as a campaign associate for the Wildlife Conservation and Animal Welfare Organization, Born Free USA, to fight against the exploitation of wildlife animals in captivity. Prior to her current position with the organization, she worked for several years as primate caregiver and veterinarian assistant at Born Free USA Primate Sanctuary in South Texas. In her current position, she researches and writes reports on target issues, including the private trade of wild animals in captivity, the effects of social media on wildlife animals, the fur trade, and tapping. Devon holds a Master's of Science degree in primate conservation from Oxford Brookes University. Welcome, Devon, to The Butterfly Effect.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm excited, and I wanted to start with your journey into this wildlife conservation field. And I'd like to know more about your transition from being a primate caregiver and a veterinarian assistant to your current role as a campaign associate. What it means, how it was, what inspired you.
I originally got interested in wildlife conservation when I was studying for my undergraduate degree in animal behavior. I took a wildlife conservation class, and I was also taking various animal behavior courses and animal biology courses. And from all of the studies that I was reading, it seemed like there was a lot of attention on helping reduce negative behaviors like stereotypies, like abnormal repetitive behaviors that wild animals do when they're kept in captivity as a result of excessive stress, trauma, boredom, the inability to perform species-specific behaviors because of spatial constraints, things like that. So I felt like there was a lot of attention on reducing the occurrence of these negative behaviors that wild animals will do in captivity as a result of the constraints of captivity compared to their wild environment. So I really thought a lot about that, and from everything I read at the time, I just came to the realization of why, unless it's for, you know, a legitimate rescue or rehabilitation center, why are people continuing to keep these wild animals not meant for captivity and who clearly cannot thrive and live a good, happy, healthy life in captivity? Why are people still taking them into captivity and keeping them there for their entire lives when they are so miserable? And this is evident to us. We've documented it time and time again. That initially got me interested in merging animal welfare with wildlife conservation and just trying to figure out how to attack the root cause of why so many wild animals are ending up in captivity and what we can do about that to keep more wildlife in the wild where they belong. That is the mission of Born Free, is to keep wildlife in the wild. I did start working for Born Free USA at the primate sanctuary that they run in South Texas as a primate caregiver, as you mentioned. And my transition to campaigns associate was very exciting because I felt like at the primate sanctuary, I loved working directly with the animals. I loved interacting directly with the monkeys there. It was also very challenging at times because you see monkeys rescued from the pet trade, from biomedical lab facilities where they were being research subjects, having research conducted on them. You also see monkeys that we rescued from roadside zoos or other zoos that are accredited but still come to us with these extreme behavioral issues. It is a very challenging job, and I knew that I wouldn't be doing that forever just because it's very physically demanding. And I wanted to attack those root causes more, like I said. Like, I wanted to be on the other side of potentially affecting legislation that could prevent more primates from entering the pet trade in the United States instead of, you know, being on the receiving end and helping the effects of allowing this to happen in the United States. So that was my initial interest in entering campaigns and going back to school to get my master's degree in primate conservation to hopefully address those issues head on and decrease the number of animals that are funneled into these really traumatic, damaging practices. And actually my first big project as a campaigns associate when I first started in this position with Born Free, coincidentally, ended up being our report that we did on the primate trade in the United States. So it was a really nice, easy transition into this position, working in some capacity with primates as I had before, just behind a computer instead of, out with them interacting.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit more about this report?
The report is called Silent Suffering, and it centers on it's called Public Danger, Private Pain, and it focuses on the private trade of primates in the United States. And we summarize the legislation currently in place in the United States in terms of which states allow which species of primates to be privately owned. We also interviewed a number of people. For example, we interviewed Tim Harrison, who is a retired first responder. So he would deal directly, he lived in Ohio, and he would deal directly with the fallout after someone's pet chimpanzee escapes their enclosure and they are attacking them or they are at large in the neighborhood. He's also dealt with other animals besides primates. So he also told stories of having to go into a house and rescue people from their python that had gotten out of their enclosure. Yeah. So really, really intense, dangerous stories. And the main takeaway I got from interviewing Tim Harrison is that first responders, who are often the ones called to handle the fallout of a dangerous wild animal escaping, so firefighters, police officers, they will be called to do this, but they don't have any training at all to deal with wild animals. So what ends up happening is most of the time they have to shoot these animals and kill them on site because the human public safety will always be prioritized over the animal's safety. So that's really the sad and dangerous part about wild animal ownership. And even, the smaller animals that aren't necessarily the tigers, the lions, the bears, the chimpanzees, smaller animals, when they escape, they will attack people. They will bite people. So they are also a public safety concern. And I think a lot of people think that, oh, if your animal is smaller than, a dog, they won't do any damage. But that's really not true because they're just not meant to be kept in captivity like that and live as a pet. Our report summarizes all of that. And also we use some of our stories from monkeys we rescued with the primate sanctuary to tell stories, individual stories of being kept as a pet for a number of years and then coming to the sanctuary and sort of following their recovery journey through that. And one of the main goals of that report was to bring public awareness to the Captive Primate Safety Act, which was introduced again to Congress in 2021. So we are still very much behind that piece of legislation being passed because it would federally ban public interactions with primates in addition to private ownership of most primate species. So that would really help a lot of these really awful public safety issues from happening so often.
And when you say that, you mean even zoos?
Yeah, correct. By public interactions with primates, I mean things like photo ops. So zoos allowing, and zoos do allow this to happen on a regular basis with many wild animal species. They will use these animals as photo props to have visitors take pictures with them very close together, sometimes touching. They'll also do things like feeding experiences with wild animals, sort of just any interaction experience that allows close physical contact with primates that would essentially be banned under this piece of legislation. And it would actually be very similar to the Big Cat Public Safety Act, which was just passed in 2022, which did the same thing. It banned public interactions with and private ownership of most big cat species in the United States. So a lot of zoos, after this piece of legislation was passed, they had to stop their interaction experiences that they were allowing with big cats.
Okay, so you use the research for legislation. Do you also use it to increase public awareness? And then if so, how do you do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So those are really our main goals in publishing these reports that we do, is to just educate the general public about these issues. Number one really just being the difference between wild animals and animals that are domesticated and have co-evolved and lived with humans for tens of thousands of years, like dogs, who thrive in captivity, who thrive living with humans. We want to really stress that the way that wild animal species have evolved in the wild, living with others of their species, hunting, ranging massive distances daily, things that you really cannot replicate in captivity, are so crucial to their well-being and their health. Really trying to stress those things and increase public awareness on the just basic biology of these animals and why they struggle so much in captivity and why they shouldn't be kept in zoos just for entertainment purposes when it really doesn't contribute to their conservation in the wild. And then that also feeds into, as you said, the legislation piece, where we try to get bans on things like private ownership of wild animals because it is so dangerous, because there's the zoonotic disease transfer risk, because it's not good, it's cruel to the animals and it damages their welfare. Really, those are the two big pieces that we want to achieve when we work on these reports and these campaigns resources.
I totally get the idea on primates, but I also understand that your organization recently released a report on fish in captivity. Can you give us some insight into the findings on the report and implication for fish in captivity, which I maybe just go back to understand why?
Absolutely. That was actually one of my favorite projects that I've worked on so far, because before that, I really had not researched fish, definitely not to that extent. But it's the same situation really for fish as the larger, better studied animals like elephants or giraffes that are kept in zoos that people are now realizing, oh, maybe that's not the best situation. Maybe that is cruel. So even though I think our main takeaways from that report is that mounting research that's coming out continues to confirm that fish are sentient. They have the same emotional capacity as a lot of other animals. They have the same social structures, complex social structures, that a lot of other animals demonstrate. They are not protected by legislation in the same way as other animals. So unless they are used for aquaculture or unless they are protected by the Endangered Species Act, there's really no legislation preventing them from abuse, neglect, or animal cruelty in captivity. So, you can keep a fish in a enclosure that's barely big enough for them to swim in a circle in with nothing else in there, and that still would not be considered to be animal cruelty. We also did a lot of research into the wild behaviors of fish, and that is a huge endeavor as it is, because there are tens of thousands of species of fish. So they are all very different from each other, obviously, but we looked at even the smallest fish, which are representative of a lot of species that are held by aquariums. So as an example, there is a species called pearly razor fish, and they grow to be about 8 inches on average. And they discovered that in the wild, they demonstrate an average home range size of a circular range of 476 feet. Okay. So that is the equivalent of 3 times the size of an Olympic swimming pool, which is a lot larger than the tanks that these fish are typically kept in aquariums. So already, just that fact alone, you see that even the smallest fish who may be relatively sedentary to other larger fish species who migrate great distances seasonally, even the smaller, more sedentary fish still have this need, this biological need to range these distances. And they are physically evolved to do that, mentally evolved to do that. And if they're constrained in such an extreme way in aquarium tanks that are orders of magnitude smaller than where they would be swimming, how much they would be swimming in the wild, you start to see the expression of abnormal behavioral manifestations, which are just for them to cope with this extreme stress, the constraints, the physical constraints, the inability to participate in these species-specific behaviors that they need really to thrive and live a meaningful life. So as a result of this constraint, you see fish do the same thing that, you know, mammals will do, which are called stereotypies, which I mentioned before, in fish that can look like them just repeatedly swimming at the edge of the tank, you know, hitting themselves over and over again. You can see it in open top enclosures where they actually try to swim out of it. Stingrays do a behavior called surfacing behavior where in an open top tank, they will continuously go up to the surface over and over again. And that may be a result of, you know, the tank not being nearly as deep as their natural habitat would be in the wild, in the water. So there's just evidence after evidence confirming that fish, like other animals, suffer in captivity. And the other thing that's really key is that most saltwater species of fish are actually captured from the wild. They're not bred in captivity. So as a result, aquariums and zoos that are taking these animals from the wild are actually depleting wild populations, and they're not contributing to their conservation in turn. So although aquariums and zoos like to state that they're helping animal conservation with having these animals in their collections, the opposite is true for fish, because they are damaging their conservation status in the wild instead of helping it, because they don't know how much they're taking from the wild is impacting the wild population statuses. It's completely unregulated, and there's just a lot wrong with it. So those would be the main takeaways from our report.
Yeah, and it actually, for me, ties to conserving ecosystem and biodiversity, right? When you take them out of their natural habitat, you do not know how you will affect the ecosystem in where you took them from, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad you mentioned the greater ecosystem, because so there's a practice in harvesting fish from the wild where they use cyanide. They spray a mixture of cyanide and I believe sodium onto the fish, which sort of stuns them for a few seconds so that they can capture them really easily. But this is obviously very damaging to the fish themselves, as they become incapacitated, and they will have some sort of trauma from that. And then also to the surrounding environment, that's a huge impact on the surrounding environment. And aquariums have actually openly said that they don't have much control over the harvesting practices that occur for them to have these fish from the wild brought into their collections. So they don't necessarily know if the people that harvest these fish are using such damaging practices like cyanide fishing. They have no idea. Currently, researchers are working to see if they can find evidence in fish DNA to see if they have been exposed to cyanide. And if they're able to confirm that, then this practice could then be more regulated. But at this point in time, there's really no way for people to regulate this practice. It's pretty crazy, the amount of things that happen.
Yeah. Which brings me to the concept of compassionate conservation. And I would love for you to explain that concept and how it guides your work in preserving the life, wildlife and their habitats.
Compassionate conservation is the idea that rather than just saving a species as a group altogether, compassionate conservation puts emphasis on individual animals as well. We think that it is just as important to save one animal as it is to save a larger group. And just saving that one animal is just as meaningful. We really put emphasis on individual experiences to speak to why larger species conservation is important. Because if one animal is experiencing something in a zoo, in an aquarium, in a lab, as a pet, that is very similar to the other animals' experiences. And we use that in our reports to tell stories of these individual animals so that people can know what happens and how damaging a lot of these practices are mentally and physically. So we use case studies a lot of the time. We've done this in our report about elephants in zoos, in our report about giraffes in zoos, also polar bears in zoos. And then we do have a few case studies in our fish report as well. It really does marry the animal welfare and conservation fields together in a way that they're working together to accomplish the same goal, which is protecting and preserving more species in the wild. I think previously a lot of the time those two fields were separated and animal welfare wasn't necessarily considered when you're trying to conserve a species as a whole. But at Born Free, we really think that you need the two to consider the two to really achieve the goal of conservation and preventing these damaging practices from happening to individuals to protect the species in the wild.
What are the biggest challenges that you are facing in this fight against the exploitation of wildlife?
I think one of the biggest challenges is the amount of misinformation, especially on social media and online, and that is presented by news outlets. I think that it's really difficult for people to really be skeptical of zoos and aquariums at this point still in the United States, because there are so many outlets and platforms that continue to promote them as things that are very positive for animals, when in reality they are not. And that's just one example. I think that same thing, the misinformation, happens for most of the campaigns that we work on. So wild animals in captivity, the exotic pet trade, the fur trade, trapping, misinformation is everywhere. So I think that's why we've also put an emphasis on publishing these reports that are very data-driven in the past, because we want to flip that narrative and educate people with facts, you know, while also presenting case studies, of course, so that people can see the emotional side of it and the lived experience of these animals. That doesn't necessarily have to do with the data we're presenting, but we sort of intertwine those two methods so that people can see the full range of how these practices impact wild animals and the extent of it. So I think social media has been especially challenging for us, because there are so many accounts that they have so much traffic that goes through. They have so many viewers, and it's really difficult to combat that and tell people, no, this practice of, you know, having a baby monkey in your house might look really cute, but it's actually really abusive and damaging. So it's a matter of countering that misinformation. I think that is one of our biggest challenges, for sure.
Obviously, people are not going to read all the reports. Give me a highlight from each report on some myth or misconception or misinformation that people has on that subject and let them know what's the real truth.
I'll start with the fur trade because we haven't talked much about that here. So with the fur trade, it's become more of a popular topic recently because of the emergence of COVID-19 on mink fur farms. And more recently, it's been in the news again with the emergence of bird flu on mink farms. And the reason that these viruses are able to spread on mink farms so rapidly and eventually be transferred to humans, which happened with COVID-19, is because mink's respiratory systems are similar to humans, and they just kind of provide the perfect condition in the fur farm environment for these viruses to be hosted and mutate and evolve into more adaptive.
Are there still mink farms? People still buy mink fur? I thought we have passed that.
No, so this is, I'm glad you mentioned that because I think this is also another topic where people just, they don't realize it still happens at the scale that it does. So fur farming of minks, foxes, rabbits, most fur-bearing animals still occurs large scale on factory-style farms. Fur farming has been one of our campaigns that we've been trying to ban for years now. The United States, China, and Russia are the three main producers of fur, so it's still very much practiced. After the spread of COVID-19 on fur farms occurred, both in Europe and the United States, a lot of countries in Europe took steps to ban fur farming and phase it out based on that public health and safety concern of viruses like COVID-19 starting the next pandemic. The United States, however, has not followed suit in the same way. We still allow fur farming to occur. We have a piece of legislation that we support called the Mink Virus Act, which would essentially phase out fur farms, but it would provide compensation for the farmers for the value of their minks. That's something that we have been campaigning for. But the myth that I was trying to get to, your original question. So a lot of proponents of fur farming argue that it is more green, it is more environmentally friendly because it's a natural resource. But the reality is fur alternatives are still far more environmentally friendly and ethical, obviously, because you're not having to kill animals to have some fashion item to wear. But the reasons that fur alternatives are more environmentally friendly are because you don't need the amount of water and food you do to feed live animals. There is no toxic runoff that is produced because there are a lot of chemicals that people don't realize that are needed to preserve the fur and the hides from the animals. So things like formaldehyde are used, and these in turn pollute the surrounding environment, pollute the water supply. There's also that public health issue and an animal health issue because some minks that escape the fur farm, they have actually given COVID-19 to wild minks, putting the surrounding ecosystem at risk. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that are wrong with fur farming, that there's the misinformation out there, if you use a plastic alternative, it's not environmentally friendly, but it is still far, the alternatives are far better and far better for the planet than, using real fur.
So what are some of the recent success stories or milestones that Born Free USA has achieved in its mission to protect wild animals and their ecosystems?
I think the Big Cat Public Safety Act, which I had mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. the passage mm-hmm. of that last year was really important. We had been, in addition to other animal protection organizations, we had been campaigning for that legislation to be passed for 10 years. It was originally introduced in 2012. It was a really long fight, but it was really necessary for big cats and to help stop the exploitative practices like cub petting, using big cats for photo ops, selling baby lions and tigers into the pet trade. things that are genuinely very dangerous for the public will be now much more controlled because of this piece of legislation. So that was a really big win for us. And something that we are excited about that's going to be new for people to keep an eye out for is a project we've been working on that will tell the stories of non-targeted trapping victims. So animals that have stepped into traps that are intended for anything people are trying to trap. So coyotes, raccoons, animals like those. So people's companion animals oftentimes will step into a trap if they are, an indoor, outdoor dog or cat, or this has happened literally when someone is taking their dog for a walk on a leash, even there will be a trap, a foothold trap just right off the trail, and their dog steps in it because no one sees it. And then, they're obviously very injured and it's really traumatic for the owner and the dog. And a lot of people don't know how to release these traps to get them off their animals. I think this is another piece where that public education is really essential, because a lot of people, especially people that live in more urban areas, don't even know that traps can be just out on public lands where people are recreating, where they're hiking, where they're taking their dog for a walk.
What are your next steps? What are you looking for? What is the next release for you guys in raising awareness and the impact for the public?
We are creating a documentary that tells the story of non-targeted trapping victims through their owners, caregivers, and rescuers. Also, we have interviews of people who have been trappers in their lives. So we have their perspective as well. And everyone really is in resounding agreement that recreational trapping should be banned. There's really no reason to allow that practice to occur legally. And yet it's still legally allowed in most of the United States. That's something that we're really looking forward to releasing. That will happen soon. That's something else that we are hoping will gain some traction for a different piece of legislation called the Refuge from Cruel Trapping Act, which would essentially ban the use of traps in National Wildlife Refuge System lands. It's a little bit ironic because you think, why are people allowed to trap on land that is intended to be like a safe haven for wildlife, right? It doesn't make sense. So this should have already not been allowed, I think, but this piece of legislation would ban trapping on that land.
So you talked a lot about the misinformation and legislations, and public does not know, and especially on social media. Where can people find the right information? And then obviously, how can they distinguish between the right and the wrong?
That's really difficult. It really is. I think for people who don't have knowledge of what animal behavior looks like, depending on the species, obviously coming to Born Free USA is a really good start. We have all of our resources, all of our reports that I've mentioned online. So the other things that you can look out for, especially on social media, that would be a red flag in terms of things that feature wild animals online, would be a human having really close, unnatural contact with that animal. If the animal isn't with any other members of their own species, if it's a really young animal that usually spends time with their mothers after they're born, whether that's a few months or a few years or their lifetime. If you look at who is posting this content and you see that they are breeding animals in captivity to be sold or just to keep for entertainment purposes, for generating money, that would be a red flag. So things like that, really, it's you kind of have to educate yourself a bit on those red flags in terms of what is wrong with the content and judge it from that. And then especially in terms of social media, we advise people not to engage or interact with posts that are problematic and just report them to the platform directly. Because if people see a problematic post, maybe it features, you know, a baby monkey kept as a pet. If people like it and they comment on it or share it, that just increases the reach of that post, of that person that posted it. So we really want to discourage that and try to get people to get in the habit of just reporting that content directly to the platform to get it taken down. And little by little, you know, as more posts are flagged, as more posts are directly sent to the platforms and outlining why this is problematic, I think more awareness will be brought to these issues and the platforms will start regulating that a bit better. But now it's really in the hands of the consumers, right? Like the viewers of this content to really take away that demand that is out there now in terms of exotic animal content that is only for entertainment or exploitative purposes. Because as long as the demand is there, the people who create this content are still gonna keep putting it out. It's really gonna take a sort of revamp of public interest and public education to, you know, flip that on its head.
Yeah, and those, the baby monkey with his mom needs to be in the forest, in the wild, not at somebody's house or backyard. Which brings me to the question of, as we bring forest into the story, what is your favorite tree?
Cherry blossom, because, and it's for a really personal reason for me. My parents' house, right in the front of it, there's a huge cherry blossom tree. And every year it produces these wonderful blossoms, these pink blossoms. Every time I see one of those trees somewhere else, I think about where I grew up and my parents. It's a very personal personal reason for that, but that's my favorite tree.
That's beautiful, and personal can be just fine. Thank you so much, Devon, for educating us on wildlife and wild animals and why they should not be in captivity. And definitely, people, if you see something, say something. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.